which made a sizable $640 million from the IPO, around $6 billion today. One group that did not profit from Ford's post-war prosperity were the former forced laborers who had worked the Cologne plant's machines during the darkest days of the war. Starting in 1995, groups of former laborers began meeting and visited the plant at the invitation of the mayor. In 1998, a former worker, Elsa Ivanova, filed a class-action lawsuit on behalf of her fellow forced laborers in New Jersey federal court. Ford's lawyers argued that the court did not have jurisdiction over an international matter. At nearly the same time, German companies BMW and Siemens set up compensation programs for the victims of their own forced labor activities during the war. Both Ford and General Motors quickly joined a similar program and paid millions to compensate the victims of their forced labor practices. Ivanova's suit, however, was dismissed on the grounds that the statute of limitations for court-ordered compensation had passed. Ford remains one of the biggest automakers in Germany and Europe to the present day. General Motors and Opel also fared well after the war, though many of their leaders did not. Former overseas president James D. Mooney never escaped the accusation of being a Nazi sympathizer. In 1947, he wrote a memoir recounting his rollicking experiences in the early days of the war, but was persuaded not to publish it by former colleagues who feared it would hurt GM's reputation. He died in 1957, after pursuing a career as a management consultant. More dramatic controversy followed his former associate, Graham Howard. At the end of the war, Howard managed to get himself appointed as a colonel in the economics division, investigating connections between German and American corporations. In April 1945, columnist Drew Pearson reported that Howard had once been in charge of GM's German operations and was now busy as a hound dog around the State Department, wanting to get back to Germany, implying that his interests extended beyond military duty. Howard met his match with the arrival of James Stewart Martin, a Justice Department lawyer sent to join his investigation team. Martin was appalled that his superior officer had once enjoyed close connections with the Nazis and sent a copy of America and the New World Order to Army headquarters. Howard was quietly dismissed by the Army brass and sent home. Martin eventually resigned his own position out of frustration at the obstruction he was encountering from American corporate interests who were eager to make profits in post-war Germany. Among his most interesting coups was tracking down Gerhard Alois Westrick, the German lawyer Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop had sent to the United States to whip up business sentiment against the country entering the war. Westrick had stayed in Berlin to nearly the end of the war, before fleeing to hide out in a castle. He was given a token jail sentence. Howard's career still had more twists in store, however. In 1948, he accepted the position of vice president and director of international operations at his old rival Ford, where he worked closely with Henry Ford II. The appointment caused a brief controversy in Congress when Democratic Representative George G. Sadowski of Michigan accused Howard of being the man who fought most vigorously on behalf of German industrialists. His Republican colleague, George A. Dondero, also from Michigan, leaped to Howard's defense and accused Sadowski of slurring one of America's foremost industrialists, a man of proven patriotism. The war of words came to nothing, and Howard remained at Ford until his retirement in 1950. He died in 1962. Obituaries around the country highlighted his 25 years as a GM executive and his later work at Ford. America and the New World Order was nowhere to be found. General Motors itself ended up profiting modestly from its business interests in the Third Reich. U.S. management lost touch with Opel around 1941, but its German leaders continued to cultivate connections with the Nazi regime. After losing control of the company, GM wrote off Opel as a tax loss in 1942. However, the Opel plant continued to operate and built trucks for the German military and aircraft components for bombers. As with Ford Werke, the labor supply was increasingly based on involuntary labor from POWs and transported civilians from occupied territories. In 1944, the Opel factories were heavily bombed, and the main factory was occupied by Allied troops in March 1945. Technically, GM still owned the controlling stake in Opel, and was therefore allowed to claim its property and the profits that had accumulated during the war. It emerged that these amounted to 22.4 million marks, including all the profits that had been locked in Germany throughout the 1930s. GM quietly repatriated these to the United States in 1951. But due to currency conversion rates, the total amount brought back was only $261,000, about $2.5 million in 2018. Decades later, Opel and GM contributed $15 million to a fund used to compensate the forced laborers who had helped generate those profits. The American businessman who had been closest to the Reich, William Rhodes Davis, was dead by the time the United States entered the war. The controversy over his ill-gotten gains continued after the war's end, however. Within days of his death, the vice president of W.R. Davis Incorporated announced a gift of 5,000 barrels of oil to Great Britain that Davis had supposedly signed off on before his demise. Whether Davis had actually done so, or whether the company's new leadership realized they needed to start repairing its reputation, is unknown. 2 weeks later, executors estimated the Davis estate at between $5 million and $10 million, or more. No doubt part of the uncertainty concerned the value of Davis's German holdings. As the war continued, more information about the extent of his connections with the Reich began to emerge. Top Nazi leaders, including Hermann Göring, were questioned by Allied investigators and gave full details of their dealings with Davis and his associates, derailing the political career of his erstwhile associate, Senator Joseph F. Guffey, who had helped with the Mexican oil scheme. The U.S. government was not done with the Davis yet, however. The FBI and Treasury Department had both been keeping an eye on Davis's finances for years, and after his death, filed a massive $38 million suit against his estate and corporate holdings. After years of legal wrangling, the government agreed to settle the case for a mere $850,000, or 3% of the original value. The settlement itself was not reported to the public until mid-1952. The turning point apparently came when the Davis estate hired the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee and President Harry Truman's former secretary as their legal counsel. The Davis family's connections to the Democratic establishment apparently survived even the revelation of his involvement with the Third Reich. Ironically, the Democratic Party itself was not done with the Davis family either. In 1952, Davis's son, Joseph Graham Davis, moved to California with his wife and son of the same name. Joseph Graham Davis Jr. entered state politics in 1974 by unsuccessfully running for state treasurer. Universally known by his nickname, Gray, he became chief of staff to Governor Jerry Brown and was elected to the state assembly in 1982. From there, he became state controller, lieutenant governor, and in 1998 was elected governor with 58% of the vote. A controversial governor, Gray Davis was recalled by voters in 2003 and replaced by former actor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, in another twist of fate, was originally from Austria. The younger Davis never knew his controversial grandfather, who had died before he was born, and was estranged from the alcoholic father who had abandoned the family in the early 1960s. William Rhodes Davis's most important political partner in 1940 had been labor leader John L. Lewis. By siding with Republican Wendell Willkie against FDR, Lewis not only harmed his credibility with the labor movement rank and file, but had also been forced to resign as head of the CIO. Yet he still remained the head of the powerful United Mine Workers, UMW, which severed its ties with the CIO in 1942. Still, Lewis was increasingly isolated, and his political clout steadily decreased. After Pearl Harbor, he pledged his loyalty to the war effort, but by 1943 was leading a series of controversial mining strikes that irked the White House. Legal battles resulted, culminating with Lewis and his associates being convicted of contempt of court and fined. National opinion had turned against the UMW, which was seen as unpatriotic and obstructionist by holding strikes during the war and afterward. Lewis held on as the controversial head of the UMW until 1960, and died in 1969. Lewis was always extremely private, if not outright secretive. Even his cause of death was never publicly revealed, and there was no public funeral, despite his larger-than-life image and continuing fame. He refused to meet with reporters and historians during his last years, and kept a low profile. As a result, historians have had difficulty piecing together the exact nature of his relationship with Davis and the Nazis. Did Lewis know that Davis was setting him up to run for president? And did he know that the scheme was supported by the German embassy? How much did he know about Davis's dealings with the Germans? Why did he so dramatically break with Roosevelt when he must have known that the decidedly anti-labor Nazis would benefit from the president being unseated? No doubt the personal differences between Roosevelt and Lewis played a major role, but this still fails to explain Lewis's willing association with Davis and his continued involvement after it should have been clear that the oil man was up to no good. The full story will probably never be known, but Lewis's reputation never recovered from the fiasco. Charles Lindbergh's reputation would never recover from his actions before the war either. After Pearl Harbor, the aviator tried to volunteer for the Army Air Corps, but was blocked by the Roosevelt administration as a defeatist. "I'll clip that young man's wings," President Roosevelt reportedly told senators. Lindbergh ended up working for his old friend Henry Ford on aircraft engine improvements. In early 1944, he was finally permitted to fly test planes in the Pacific Theater, and eventually took part in combat missions against the Japanese. By this time, however, the American public was in no mood to revive Lindbergh's reputation, or even hear from him further. A 1942 poll found that just 10% of voters had a favorable view of Lindbergh, and 81% unfavorable. After the war, Lindbergh's old plane, the Spirit of St. Louis, ended up on display in the new National Air Museum, now the National Air and Space Museum, in Washington, D.C. The man who had flown it in 1927 would be much less publicly venerated. Lindbergh spent many of his later years writing relatively successful memoirs and other books documenting his experiences in the heady days of the 1920s. In the 1950s and 1960s, he worked as a government consultant on a variety of projects, including environmental policy issues for the Nixon administration. Toward the end of his life, he became involved in a variety of conservationist causes, including the World Wildlife Fund, and spent most of his time in Hawaii. He died in 1974 and was buried near his home on the island of Maui. The man who had come closest to uniting the American far right never overcame the consequences of becoming Hitler's key American friend, whether he intended to or not. Yet, as the scars of those years have faded, Lindbergh's reputation has undergone a sort of renaissance. 2 decades after his death, a poll found that 54% of Americans regarded Lindbergh as a hero, while 36% disagreed. This was a result Lindbergh could never have expected to see in his lifetime. The appeal and charm of Lucky Lindy's story has never lost its appeal for the American public, despite the ignominious chapters of his career. Many of America First's, and Lindbergh's, most vocal supporters have been found at American universities. As already heard, the organization's original founder was Yale law student Robert Douglas Stewart, Jr., who moved on to become its national director. Students at universities across the country formed their own local chapters of the group, particularly in its Midwestern stronghold. University of Nebraska students, for instance, formed a campus chapter in October 1941. Less than 2 months before Pearl Harbor. The group's faculty advisor described its aims as keeping out of foreign wars, preserving and defending democracy at home, keeping American ships out of war zone, building an impregnable defense, and supplying the peoples of occupied countries with food and clothing. The question of war and peace was more than just political for the country's university students and young people generally. In the event of war, there would be little choice but to either face combat or join the war effort in other capacities. It is impossible to know how many of the American students who studied in the Third Reich joined America First or harbored sympathies for Germany, ended up dead in the war they had opposed. It is, however, possible to trace the fate of some. For his part, Stuart entered the Army after Pearl Harbor as a field artillery officer. He survived the war and embarked on a sterling corporate career befitting his family background. His first employer was Quaker Oats, the company his father had helped found. Now, the son followed in his father's footsteps and eventually rose to become company president in the mid-1960s, and later CEO. Even in the midst of his high-flying corporate career, Stuart remained interested in the legacy of America First. In 1963, he corresponded with former America First chairman Robert E. Wood and publisher Henry Regnery, the son of a leading America First member, about the prospect of commissioning an official history of the organization. Stuart's primary concern was that the author of such a book not be one of those who are instinctively critical of our efforts. Nothing seems to have come of the plan, though books about America First began showing up regardless. Ironically, Regnery had declined the opportunity to publish one of the first and most famous books on the subject back in 1951, claiming it would not be financially viable. Stuart remained a diehard Republican throughout his life, and eventually served as Ronald Reagan's Illinois campaign finance chair. Reagan rewarded him with an appointment as U.S. ambassador to Norway in 1984. After returning to the United States in 1989, he obtained appointments from President George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton to serve on the Defense Base Realignment and Closure Commission, tasked with evaluating post-Cold War military facility closures. Stuart died in 2014 at the age of 98. His creation of America First featured in many obituaries, but only as a minor part of his lengthy career. At the time of his death, he appears to have been one of the last surviving leaders of America First. His much older colleague, America First Chairman Robert E. Wood, died in 1969. Successful, though far less high profile, careers awaited several of the students who had been so adamant in their praise of the Third Reich during their time at Columbia University. Henry Miller Madden, the PhD student who turned his affinity for Germany into anti-Semitism and embarked on an extended European trip before the war, ended up in the U.S. Navy. As already heard, he had attempted to convince the military that he was a conscientious objector, evidently to no avail. After a series of training assignments, he was sent to join the staff of Vice Admiral Robert L. Gormley in occupied Berlin. His task there was to help negotiate a tripartite agreement with British and Soviet representatives and determine the fate of the surviving German Navy. As a lifelong Germanophile, Madden must have recognized the irony in the fact that he was now part of a foreign military occupying his beloved Berlin. After the war, Madden returned to his academic career and finished his PhD, but struggled to find employment as a professor. In 1949, he changed careers and accepted a job as a librarian at Fresno State College. In a twist of fate, he was relocating to the same small California city where Fritz Wiedemann had covertly reunited with Princess Stephanie a few years earlier. Madden remained in the post for nearly the rest of his life. Unexpectedly, he appears to have abandoned many of his earlier views to become an outspoken supporter of academic freedom. In 1957, he was elected president of the California Library Association. "Books contain our record, both good and bad," he told a student group in 1964. Perhaps with his own example in mind, he concluded, "Books look in silence from their shelves at our antics and our follies, at our acts of creation and our acts of destruction. Books are mirrors of the age in which they were written, and it is only through them that one can develop a sense of the appropriate." Madden remained in his post until 1979 and dramatically extended his library's collections, in part by traveling to his old stomping grounds in Europe and purchasing rare books using the linguistic skills he honed decades earlier. He died in 1980, and the library was named in his honor the following year. The Henry Madden Library remains one of the largest public libraries in California to the present day, and serves as an unexpected legacy for a man who once considered himself one of Hitler's American friends, however briefly. Madden was not the only one-time Nazi-sympathizing student to find success in later years. His one-time correspondent at Columbia, William Oswald Shanahan, went on to an academic career of his own. Completing his PhD in history, Shanahan worked as a professor at Notre Dame, Cornell, the University of Oregon, and Hunter College. In 1963, he was invited to West Germany to report on the status of history instruction in the country, indicating the level of prestige he obtained in the field. He died in 1990 and was remembered as a well-respected historian and teacher. Neither Madden nor Shanahan seem to have been significantly impacted in their careers by their one-time views toward Hitler. Whether these views could be attributed to youthful indiscretion or reflect a deep-held prejudice that became unacceptable to express in public later remains unclear. These were, after all, private opinions that undoubtedly influenced personal conduct, but never seemed to have become a wider issue even at the time. Perhaps both men's views were changed by the war and the passage of time. Alternatively, it is possible they became caught up in the tenuous political atmosphere at Columbia and fed off the views they heard around them. If so, their example serves as a strong indictment of the university administrators and faculty members who cultivated a Nazi-friendly atmosphere at Columbia and other universities at a critical moment. Perhaps they were even taken advantage of by Hitler's propaganda network in the United States, just as John C. Metcalf had warned the Dias Committee was taking place. Regardless, Shanahan and Madden followed the example of so many Americans and seemed to have simply moved on with life and changing times after the war. Much the same was undoubtedly true for most of the young people who became temporarily enmeshed with Hitler's American friends. Hitler's spy network in the United States was almost completely shut down well before the war's end. The failure of the 1942 Nazi sabotage operation was humiliating for Hitler, and ended with the execution of 6 saboteurs and the imprisonment of the other 2. The Nazis would never again attempt such a bold and foolish plot in the United States. The 2 saboteurs who were spared, George John Dash and Ernest Peter Berger, had their sentences commuted, but still faced decades behind bars. In 1948, however, President Harry Truman abruptly ordered both men released from prison and deported to West Germany. By showing clemency, Truman hoped he could convince other plotters against the United States to turn themselves in and cooperate with authorities. Berger soon adopted a new identity and embarked on a career as a businessman. Dash could not escape his past so easily, however. He wandered the country, facing harassment and death threats from former Nazis when his past became known. At one point, he contacted the German Communist Party in the hope of setting up a new life in the East. Party officials suspected that Dash might be an American spy, and he was warned to return to the West while he could. In 1959, he published a memoir of his experiences, but was still denied the presidential pardon he had allegedly been promised decades before. Throughout the 1950s and 1960s, he requested admittance to the United States, but was consistently denied at the personal request of J. Edgar Hoover, who resented the idea of anyone but the FBI getting credit for breaking up the sabotage plot. However, the end of Dash's story remains somewhat uncertain. A 1980 investigation by the Atlanta Constitution discovered that Dash's voluminous FBI file cut off abruptly in 1966, but there was no record of his death. No recent trace of him could be found in official documents, and an obituary search turned up nothing. Family members and former associates claimed they had no idea what had become of the missing man. A former FBI agent suggested it was possible that Dash had been quietly allowed to enter the United States and was living under an assumed name. Some authors have claimed that Dash remained in Germany, presumably living under an assumed identity, and died around 1992. No conclusive proof either way has seemingly ever been revealed. For all intents and purposes, Dash simply disappeared from history. The same was true for many of the agents who served the Third Reich. The FBI has publicly identified around 100 Nazi agents who were convicted of various offenses during the World War II period. Most were American citizens, and many had been born in the United States. While lengthy sentences were given to the most prominent spies and ringleaders, most convicted agents received modest sentences of a few years to a decade behind bars, and were presumably released from prison at some point after the war. Many appear to have changed their names and tried to start new lives. High school student Lucy Baimler, for instance, was just 19 when she was sent to prison for 5 years for her involvement in the Kurt Friedrich Ludwig spy ring. She would have only been in her early 20s when released. Yet a newspaper archive search shows no trace of her in the post-war world. Presumably, she chose to disappear into obscurity and as much normalcy as could be managed. While it is unlikely that any of Hitler's agents are still alive at the time of writing, many probably went on to live normal and full lives after the war's end. A grimmer and more abrupt end met their Abwehr boss in Berlin. As it turned out, Admiral Wilhelm Canaris and his sabotage chief, Erwin von Lahusen, were secretly leading double lives throughout the Third Reich. While ostensibly doing the Führer's bidding, both men were opposed to the regime and became members of the resistance. On July 20, 1944, German officer Klaus von Stauffenberg planted a suitcase bomb in a room in Hitler's Wolf's Lair headquarters in East Prussia. The blast was intended to kill Hitler and decapitate the regime, but instead only wounded him. Believing the Führer was dead, Stauffenberg and his fellow conspirators tried to take control of the government, but were overpowered. In the wake of the assassination plot, thousands of army officers and political leaders of the Reich were arrested. Lahusen was already fighting on the Eastern Front and had been involved in the plot, possibly by helping supply the bomb itself, but managed to conceal his involvement. He would survive the war and go on to testify against his former associates in the Third Reich in the Nuremberg trials. He quietly lived out his days in his native Austria and died in 1955. Canaris was less lucky. He had already been under Gestapo surveillance for months before the Stauffenberg plot and was swiftly arrested. The admiral was imprisoned for months, and in April 1945, with the Reich collapsing, was convicted of treason in a summary trial. Facing certain death, Canaris requested the honor of death in combat against advancing Soviet troops. The request was denied, and hours later, he was brutally hanged with piano wire on a meat hook. It took half an hour for the Abwehr chief to die. 3 weeks later, Abwehr agents blew up the overseas message center that had been used to communicate by shortwave radio with its agents in the United States to prevent it falling into Allied hands. The two people who had once called themselves Hitler's friends and then changed their minds fared somewhat better. After being detained for overstaying her visa, Princess Stephanie von Hohenlohe started a relationship with the married commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, Lemuel B. Schofield. Its days were numbered, however. Princess Stephanie was arrested immediately after Pearl Harbor as a potential threat to national security. Ironically, she was held in a prison block full of avowed Nazis who regarded her as suspicious because of her Jewish appearance. Her usual machinations failed to gain her release, and she remained behind bars until May 1945. Remarkably, she then reunited with Schofield and spent the next decade living the high life off his income. He died in 1955. Princess Stephanie then reinvented herself yet again. As it turned out, she had a distant connection to the wife of political columnist Drew Pearson, who had broken many of the stories related to the Viereck propaganda operation. The pair had met decades before, and now Pearson offered to help her enter the Washington political scene. Over the next 20 years, Stephanie wrote articles for German magazines and newspapers using Pearson's access and network of contacts. Remarkably, she even scored an interview with President John F. Kennedy in 1963 and several with President Lyndon B. Johnson. She died in 1972, colorful as ever in her old age, and with her name still showing up in the papers. Her one-time lover and co-conspirator, Fritz Wiedemann, was arrested by the Allies in Tientsin, China, at the end of the war. He was interrogated by OSS officers, who found him helpful and willing to answer their questions about German intelligence operations. He was soon taken to Washington for further questioning and cooperated again. Asked what should happen to his former associates in the Third Reich, he told interrogators that the worst war criminals deserved the death penalty. He later served as an official witness at the Nuremberg trials and was officially denazified by paying a 2,000 Deutschmark, about $6,000 in 2018, fine in 1948. He and Stephanie eventually reconnected, and she helped him write and publish his memoirs. Wiedemann lived out his days as a Bavarian gentleman farmer dressed in Lederhosen, as a 1968 newspaper article put it. He died in 1970. The opulent mansion that served as his consular headquarters in San Francisco and the center of his international spy network still stands at the corner of Laguna and Jackson Streets. After the war, it served as the first permanent headquarters of the California Historical Society. There was another aspect to Wiedemann's story that only emerged later, however. During the Nuremberg trials, a German-American woman living in New York named Kate Eva Horlin provided a startling deposition. In 1934, she recounted, she and her first husband, a well-known newspaper music critic, were living in Munich. One evening, four men in SS uniforms arrived to take her husband to Dachau, mistaking him for a local SA leader they were intending to shoot as part of the Night of the Long Knives purge. After desperately seeking information about his fate for days, Horlin was told he had been shot by accident in Dachau. Horlin and the prominent owner of her husband's newspaper both contacted the Gestapo to ask why her husband had been killed. Remarkably, the Gestapo admitted that the shooting had been a mistake and offered Horlin money to drop the matter, which she refused. As the Gestapo became more persistent, Horlin went to Nazi Party headquarters, where she encountered Wiedemann. Hearing her terrible story, Wiedemann arranged for a personal apology from Reich Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess, along with a formal letter stating her husband had not been guilty of any crime. He also managed to secure her a pension equivalent to her late husband's salary. In 1937, Horlin and her children moved to New York and became American citizens in 1944. She never forgot the unexpected kindness she received, telling investigators, "In fairness, I should state that Captain Wiedemann, formerly an influential member of the NSDAP, was at all times genuinely sympathetic with my case, and I feel that I owe more to him for having protected me from the Gestapo than to any other individual." This turned out to not be the only compassionate act Wiedemann had undertaken in the Reich. In 2010, historian Thomas Weber revealed that the captain personally helped several Jewish former members of his, and Hitler's, First World War unit survive the Holocaust. Despite his history as one of the Führer's closest confidants, in some instances, he had more compassion than anyone at the time could have imagined. The failure of Hitler's friends ultimately stands as a testimony to the resilience of the American political system. President Roosevelt repeatedly showed great foresight in pushing the FBI to investigate right-wing subversives, when J. Edgar Hoover himself wanted to focus on other priorities. The president's backdoor cooperation with British security coordination allowed the disruption of major German intelligence and propaganda efforts, including Viereck's Capitol Hill operation. Without British intelligence assistance, particularly in the key 1940 to 1941 period, German success in subverting the United States would have been much more likely. Prime Minister Winston Churchill and William Stevenson both deserve credit for allowing politically risky intelligence operations to be undertaken at this critical moment. Given the dire military situation, The British had little choice but to take risks, and in this case, it paid off handsomely. American public opinion did not immediately swing toward intervention in the European War, but it did progressively allow Roosevelt a freer hand to aid the British. Despite his committee's questionable techniques, even Martin Dyess Jr. deserves credit for helping bring down the Bund and the Silver Legion. When we began our work, the Bund and a score of Nazi-minded American groups were laying plans for an impressive United Front Federation, a federation which would be able to launch a first-rate Nazi movement in the United States, Dyess told Americans in a December 1940 radio address. By our exposure of these plans, we smashed that Nazi movement even before it was able to get underway. There was an element of truth to this. Dyess would go on to a controversial post-war career and become associated with the excesses of McCarthyism. But for a few critical years, he was a major thorn in the side of Hitler's American friends. Finally, credit must be given to America's two political parties for their own discipline in this critical period. The Republican Party nominated the interventionist Wendell Willkie in 1940 rather than an isolationist. Neither party's leaders seriously considered nominating Charles Lindbergh, the only man who would have been able to unite the far-right factions under the banner of America First. Kansas Republicans disavowed Gerald B. Winrod at the key moment he might have become Hitler's most powerful political friend in the country. Both parties kept their distance from the likes of Gerald L.K. Smith and Father Coughlin. After the war, most of the isolationists who had been involved in Viereck's propaganda scheme saw their political careers end abruptly. These were undoubtedly difficult calls for politicians to make, attacking members of one's own party and alienating current or potential supporters is never easy. Lindbergh might well have been able to capture the White House for the Republicans in 1940, especially if he had been backed with the millions of dollars supposedly stashed in the German embassy for William Rhodes Davis to dispense. The prospect of a charismatic celebrity taking an isolationist foreign policy platform all the way to the White House was by no means impossible. But at what cost? 20th century American history would have pivoted in a completely different and unknowable direction, with vast consequences for millions of people around the globe. For whatever their flaws then and now, America's political parties and leaders rose to the challenge presented by this moment in history. In many cases, politicians made the difficult decision to act on principle and patriotism, rather than out of political expediency and the pursuit of victory at any price. The far right could never find its American Führer, and the country's political parties ensured that none of the leading candidates, ranging from outlandish options like Fritz Kuhn or William Dudley Pelley, to more plausible options like Father Coughlin or Charles Lindbergh, would ever get the chance to make a bid for the position. The American political system survived a series of major existential threats at a moment when the fate of the free world hung in the balance. In the face of such courageous stands by America's leaders, Hitler's friends never stood much of a chance. Appendix: Hitler's American Friends in Numbers. Group and/or classification, followed by approximate membership. Executed German saboteurs. 6. Convicted Nazi spies in the United States. 100. Friends of the New Germany. 5,000 at its peak. German-American Bund. Ordnungsdienst. OD. 5,000 at its peak. Silver Legion members. 15,000 at its peak. German-American Bund members. 20,000 at its peak. Votes for Gerald B. Winrod in Kansas GOP primary, 1938. 53,000. German-American Bund sympathizers. 100,000 at its peak. Silver Legion sympathizers. 100,000 at its peak. Subscribers to The Defender by Gerald B. Winrod. 100,000. Subscribers to Social Justice by Father Coughlin. 200,000 minimum, up to 1 million. America First members, 800,000. Nationwide votes for Coughlin-backed presidential candidate William Lemke, 1936 election. 892,000 votes. Americans agreeing Jews should be deported to some new homeland as fast as it can be done without inhumanity, 1939 Fortune poll. 13 million. Semi-weekly or more frequent Father Coughlin listeners, in 1938. 15 million. Monthly Father Coughlin listeners, in 1938. 29 million. This is Chris Andrew Shula. We hope you've enjoyed Hitler's American Friends, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos. Text copyright 2018 by Bradley W. Hart. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.